Hello and welcome back to Unusual Sources. This is Peter Leibovich on CFMU 93.3. Today we have a special guest from all the way from Israel-Palestine in the studio with two of the coordinators of his trip. Our special guest today is Jeff Halper. He's the head of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolition in the West Bank and Gaza. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thank you much.
With him is David Cohn, the chair of the Independent Jewish Voices in Hamilton and a lecturer of Mohawk. David?
Thank you very much, Peter.
You've been on the program a couple of times, so he's familiar. And also helping with this trip, but also working, a woman who has worked with Jeff in Jerusalem, where she was the coordinator, the international coordinator for the Committee Against House Demolition, Lucia Pizarro. And also now living, currently living in Toronto, right? And belongs to Not In Our Name and the Inter-Jewish Anti-Zionist Committee, right?
Something like that.
Something like that. correct me if I'm wrong. Welcome to the program.
Thank you much.
So, Jeff, the committee that you belong to, obviously, in its name is what it does. But your tour was planned here before the invasion of Gaza.
That's right. That's right. Well, I'm the head of an organization that's dedicated, an Israeli organization that's dedicated to ending the occupation completely. But we focus on the issue of house demolitions, as you can tell from our name. Israel has a policy of demolishing Palestinian homes, I mean, since 1948. But in the occupied territories, the areas conquered by Israel since 1967, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, Israel has demolished something like 25,000 Palestinian homes since 1967. And we estimate, conservatively, I think, that between 10 and 20,000 homes have been demolished in the last few weeks in Gaza. So this emphasizes two things. First of all, it's a war against the people. It's a war against the Palestinian people. And second of all, that the issue is not terrorism, the issue is not security, the issue is a proactive policy on the part of Israel to take control of the entire country and either drive the Palestinians out, which Israel would prefer to do, we use the word transfer for that, or at least to lock them into a Bantustan. So this latest political process that's known as the Annapolis process is intended to create a Palestinian Bantustan and really create the new apartheid regime in our world.
It's kind of symbolic that in this war, I mean, they call it a war, but it's basically it is destruction of houses. There was no two armies fighting.
I mean, it's not a war. The Palestinians don't have a state. They don't have an army. It was, first of all, Gaza was a massacre, period. I mean, I don't think there's any other word for it. And in the Israeli assault on Gaza, and you see this in other places, the same thing happened in 2002 in the West Bank when Israel pacified the West Bank. You know, the Jenin refugee camp was destroyed. Every Palestinian city was virtually destroyed, especially the infrastructure in 2002. So Gaza is simply, because Gaza is the last remaining stronghold of resistors to the Israeli occupation. And so you want to destroy not only Hamas, but the people that support Hamas or support the Palestinian resistance. So that it's the same thing, whether it's the West Bank or Gaza. You see columns of the Israeli army going in, led by a tank, followed by a bulldozer. Followed by a tank, followed by a bulldozer, so that the bulldozer and tank, they jostle with each other on who's going to get there first, the tank to shoot people and the bulldozer to destroy the infrastructure. You know, Israel destroyed in 3 weeks in Gaza more than $2 billion of infrastructure. Hospitals, schools, homes, roads. And Gaza didn't have much infrastructure before that. Had no sewage system. Israel had already destroyed the port, the seaport. It had destroyed the airport. The roads were impassable. You could hardly drive on them. The agriculture had been destroyed. So after the destruction of the last 41 years, an intentional de-development policy, destruction. Remember, Israel invaded Gaza a couple of years ago and did the same thing. There's been international sanctions that Canada is a part of in the last 2 years that are starving the Palestinian people in Gaza. After all of this, Israel still found $2 billion of infrastructure to destroy. I don't know where they found it. But you can imagine what's left in Gaza today. Nothing.
Now, when we say when, you can imagine you've been in Gaza too, because one of the right. one of the things that you were involved with, and we saw finally there was some coverage of it when Cynthia McKinney was on a boat that got rammed, and it was covered on CNN. But right. you were on the first boat that broke the siege in Gaza, right?
In August, there have been five boats that have managed to get through. Cynthia McKinney was on the sixth one that was rammed by the army and limped into a port in Lebanon. And another boat tried last week and was turned back by the Israeli Navy. This is a movement called the Free Gaza Movement to break the siege. It's political. It's not humanitarian. We oppose the mixing of the two. It's a political attempt by bringing boats through the blockade to break the siege of Gaza and to highlight the fact, first of all, that there is a siege, you know, because Israel tries to present a situation in which the Palestinian, there's no more occupation. So we say there is an occupation. You have to sail in from Cyprus to get there. You know, there's a siege all the way around. Secondly, that it's an Israeli siege. Israel is not the victim. It's not the defender. It's not the weak party. Israel is in control of Gaza. And third, that this is an international blockade that Canada is a part of. You know, so that the international community bears a lot of responsibility for the destruction and the suffering that's taken place and for the lack of any progress towards peace, because it will not give effective backing to Palestinians, and in fact, it backs Israel and its occupation policies.
You told me something that when you were on that boat was the first boat that's ever boat
that's right.
aside from fishing boats that's ever right. entered the harbor in 40 years.
That's right. We sailed in, 40,000 people. The Gazans came out to greet us because we were the first boats to come in. In 40 years. There are local fishing boats, but even that is a sad sight because the entire coast of Gaza is littered with fishing boats. 10, 15 years ago, there were about 25,000 fishermen. You know, Gaza is on the Mediterranean. And according to the Oslo peace agreements, the Gazan fishermen have 20 miles of sea in which to fish. They can go out 20 miles in Gazan waters. In fact, Israel has always limited them to 6 miles. So when they get out to a 6-mile mark, the Israeli Navy fires on them. 14 Palestinian fishermen have died, have been killed in the last few years. Today, there's not more than 200 Palestinian fishermen that go out. I went out with the fishermen in solidarity, and the problem with the 6-mile mark, you know, Israel's destroyed the sewage system. Gaza is 1.5 million people that exists on a lake of sewage, and a couple of years ago, in fact, there was a sewage flood in which people drowned and died. I mean, I can't begin to tell you the conditions. Gaza is the most densely populated part of the world. It's twice the population, the density of Bangladesh. So the sewage then flows into the sea. And what Israel does is it limits the Palestinian fishermen to a small piece of the sea that's completely polluted with sewage. And that they're fishing in sewage. They're fishing in an area that's all fished out already, so they're just getting little tiny fish. And there is no more fishing industry. So this is a good example of collective punishment against a civilian population, which is illegal in international law. And Canada, that prides itself on being a human rights country and a peacemaker and all of that, should be the first country to stand up and oppose it.
We're speaking with Jeff Helper, who's touring Canada. He's head of the Israeli Committee Against Hostile Demolitions and part of the Free Gaza movement in Israel. Jeff, when you say that Canada has a responsibility, and this has been, and you cannot, you started one sentence with, you cannot begin to imagine. The problem is that there has been no reporting until the bombings. People didn't know what was happening in Gaza. I mean, David, I know with the Independent Jewish Voice, is just getting the story out that there, that Gaza, it was already under siege, was not known here in Canada.
Well, that's true, except that, as our name implies, Independent Jewish Voices, one of our members, Harry Shannon, went there, went to Gaza a few months ago, and came back with a searing eyewitness account of what's going on, and it's quite similar to Jeff's. I mean, it's just the conditions there are inconceivable, and so I just want to say that that it's Independent Jewish Voices is very proud to be a part of Jeff's tour in Canada, and as you just heard, this is certainly a very valuable alternative Jewish voice, and so we're extremely happy to be part of Jeff's being here, and he'll be speaking tonight.
Don't forget that.
Yes, I'll certainly plug this. He'll be speaking tonight in the Health Sciences Center, room A1, that's room 1A1 at 7:30. So to hear more Jeff Halpert, please do come out.
And for those of you who might not know what Health Science Center is, McMaster Hospital, room 1A1.
Thank you.
Jeff, in this trip, have you had the occasion to meet with any of the political leaders in Canada and bring this message to them about what's happening?
Well, you know, unfortunately, you can't meet with the ruling classes. You know, they pretty much close themselves off, and both the conservative and liberal parties have terrible and almost identical positions on this. I met with a couple of liberal MPs, you know, because you have individuals who are sympathetic. But, you know, the problem is you have, I guess, like the United States, a Tweedledee, Tweedledum political spectrum. The only little acknowledgement I got was by meeting with NDP people. I met with the NDP representatives in Halifax and in Ottawa. And I think they're sympathetic. Unfortunately, the NDP, for some reason, isn't really stepping out on this issue. And you know, I mean, I'm not a Canadian, and I'm certainly not going to give advice. But it would seem to me
that we'll take your advice.
All right. I mean, I think, to tell you the truth, and I think it's true all over the world, I think most people, if they're informed, and your question, why didn't they know this, is a very good question. I think people should start investigating who's controlling their newspapers and who's controlling the news and who's controlling who can speak and so on. I mean, but in addition to that, the I think most people are liberal to radical. Most people want what the left wants. You want good health care, you want human rights, you want inclusivity, you want a good life, you want prosperity, you want to get along with your neighbor. And for some reason, the left, I don't know if we have an inferiority complex, but we think that the people are on the right, and we have to pander to the right. We have to. So why the, I mean, if the NDP would stand up But explain to the people, we are in favor of a just peace in Israel-Palestine. This is a global conflict that affects our country. We have troops in Afghanistan, and the NDP, like the people of Canada, want to be a part of a peaceful world, and we're committed to human rights. I think you would, you know, that party could step out instead of being, you know, the fourth wheel on the same vehicle. You know, it could be. It could really, I think, present a message that resonates with the Canadians. So it's good politics, but it's also good a good moral and political position. But you have a dynamic in Canada where you have, you know, as you know, four parties that really don't differ from each other very much as on this issue, at least.
Couldn't have said it better myself, Jeff. I want to go to another point because there's been a lot of the war, in a sense, or the massacre, has focused the debate as never seen before, not in my lifetime, in terms of the political debate of what's happening in the Middle East, and the ability and the ability for people to start discerning between the state of Israel and being Jewish. It's one of the big arguments, right? The state of Israel is a Jewish state, and if you attack the state of Israel, you're attacking Jews. As someone who's been
active, and the state of Israel is massacring people in your name, yes, if you're Jewish.
Yes.
Which is a problematic thing, I would think.
So, that's my question. In Israel, I mean, in doing this human rights work, the kind of debates that are occurring in the state of Israel itself, because, again, in the North American press, I'm not talking about the rest of the world. I have a feeling that our press is probably more one-sided than maybe even the Israeli press.
That's right, for sure.
How does that debate go over in terms of what you're doing with the Jewish population in Israel?
I mean, there is no debate. More than 80% of the Israeli Jewish public in Israel supported this last military campaign, the invasion, the assault on Gaza. So the debate is very limited. Not because there aren't differences of opinion, but, you know, fear is a very effective way of manipulating people. So the Israeli people have been told by all their leaders, right to left, that there is no political solution. Arabs are Arabs. They just want to throw us into the sea. You can't trust them. There's no partner for peace, and so on. And so in a sense, the Israelis have taken that, because who tells them that? They're generals. And, you know, generals, I mean, if generals must know, this is their business. So that they have a lot of clout when they speak. So that the Israeli public, I think, has been disempowered and neutralized. Because they'll say, look, we want peace with the Arabs, but we can't have it because they won't let us. Because they'll look at Hamas, we're out of Gaza, and Hamas is throwing rockets. In other words, the Israeli public does not see that there's an occupation. I mean, it's ironic, but we don't use the word occupation in Israel. You never say that word. Israel, in fact, officially denies that there is an occupation. Israel says, this is our country. How do you occupy your own country? And so everything is reduced then to terrorism, and they're the bad guys, and they're the problem, and therefore there is no political solution because it's not even political. It's mystified. It's a clash of civilizations kind of a thing. So the Israeli people say, look, you know, if we can't get to a solution, to a resolution of this, at least we want our personal safety. And so they rely on the army to do what it has to do. And they don't care what happens to Palestinians. So when the army invades Gaza, they say, you know, we're just defending ourselves because of the rockets, without seeing that Israel broke the ceasefire before the rockets were fired in November by killing Hamas people in Gaza. They don't see a 20-year campaign of assassinations of Palestinian leaders. They don't see Israeli attacks all through the ceasefire, you know, from helicopters in the sky. There was a whole family, if you remember last year, that was massacred on a beach. They're having a picnic on a beach, and a shell came from a ship off sea. So Israel has continuously hit the Palestinian civilian population violently by sea, by air, by land. And yet, you know, the Israelis, you know, sort of the idea is, well, you know, we can do that because we have an army. We're defending ourselves. That's the whole discourse. So when they react and throw rockets, then, you see, now that proves that they're the bad guys. And now, so the whole thing is like a closed video system. you know, in which there's, you know, it's just our story is the only story, and so the army can do whatever it wants to do. I guess the part of the bad news is, and that's true in Canada as well, is that people aren't critical. They don't, the media doesn't report critically. And people, yeah, we're sitting in a university here. People are not educated to think critically. I come to universities and it's demanded that I give a balanced presentation. There isn't any such animal as a balanced presentation. Even a mathematician on mathematics won't give you a balanced presentation. You're coming from some school or some, you know, there isn't any such thing. And so we have to teach students and teach the population to think critically, to look, read between the lines, to really ask, is what we're being told true? And to care about these issues because they do impact on your lives. I think the Canadian people, as much as the Israeli people, have been disempowered by their governments, by the media, and so in a sense they don't get it, and they don't even know that they don't get it. So it's very hard to mobilize the people to be in support of peace and the Palestinians and the Israelis who want peace, whether you're inside Israel or in Canada.
Although there has been more movement on this issue than has been in the last 40 years. I mean, the pictures. I can now understand why they didn't allow the press in. Because even though Al Jazeera doesn't have access to our TV waves here in North America.
Which is something to ask a question about.
The pictures that came out, you can't hide them. It's created a debate that has made the Zionists and the apologists for the Zionists more uncomfortable than I've ever seen. It's really hard to hide a massacre when you have somebody taking pictures. So the movement, the debate seems to be occurring here more than before. It's just that what we haven't seen is political leaders willing to voice
the
opinions of hundreds of thousands of Canadians. There's no political leader that neither in the United States or in Canada. When talking about political leaders, I understand today Obama made his first international move was to talk to four leaders in the Middle East.
And not to Harper.
What was that all about? He's going to visit Harper first.
We get
the first visit.
Oh, okay.
But what he said, I'll ask for people's opinion. He talked to Abbas, he talked to Omer, he talked to
Mubarak, Abdullah,
yeah.
I think.
And the first thing out of his mouth is that he wouldn't guarantee that there's no smuggling of arms back into Gaza. But never in any of his conversations did he acknowledge the massacre or even the death and destruction that the Gazans have suffered.
I haven't heard that. I've heard of the phone calls. I haven't heard of the content because I've been running around all day. But even our language misleads us, you know. What you just said is what you always hear, and that's what he would say too. Because states are off the hook. States aren't responsible. So Israel is getting from the United States about $3 to $4 billion of arms every year. And these are, some of them are pretty nasty weapons. Phosphorus bombs that burn you alive. Cluster bombs that rip you apart. I mean, there's some pretty nasty things. But that's okay. Because a state has the right to import arms, right? Israel's going to get $30 billion worth of arms from the United States over the next 10 years. But the Palestinians don't have a state. So they're non-state actors. So they can't import arms. They smuggle arms. You see? So Israel can bring in arms to massacre Palestinians. And there's no argument about it because it's a state that has a right to import. But the Palestinians have no right to resist because resistance is terrorism. And if they try to get small arms, I mean, they don't have tanks, they don't have an army. If they try to get small arms, either to defend themselves because they're the ones that are being attacked or to resist, then they're smuggling. They're criminals. You see, even our language is skewered in a way that it supports the strong and it criminalizes the oppressed people.
And that comes from right out of the mouth of Netanyahu in those conferences in the 80s when they changed the word from resistance to terror.
That's right.
And now it's being used anywhere in the world. People do forget that the UN Charter gives the right to an occupied people to resist their occupation.
That's right.
It's part of the rights under the UN.
Armed resistance.
Yes.
Among other things. That's right.
And that right has now been... And it's taking from a political debate to it's criminal. Arrest them, put them in jail. We don't have to debate this anymore.
One of the interesting things, just to throw something out here, is this whole... The word terrorism is skewered. You know, there's an interesting book called Death by Government by a guy named Rummel, who says that over the course of the 20th century, about 170,000 innocent people have been killed by what we call terrorist groups. In other words, non-state actors, which is a lot of people, and that shouldn't be. In other words, the Palestinians have a right to resist, even armed resistance. They do not have a right to attack civilians. Nobody does. But we only hold them accountable. Because Rummel says over the course of the 20th century, between 170 million and 360 million innocent people have been killed by states. So if we say terrorism is the harming and killing of innocent people, states are infinitely more culpable than the actors we call terrorists. And here again is the way our language is used to legitimize state violence, state terrorism, and to demonize the resistance. And that's a real danger. If resistance to states becomes illegitimate, you know, the states have an open field for oppression. For example, if you go out in the street here in Hamilton and you ask the people who are the insurgents, they'll tell you they're the bad guys. They're the guys our soldiers are fighting. You know, so all of a sudden the states are the good guys and the insurgents are the bad. The insurgents are the people. In Mexico City, one of the main avenues of Mexico City is called the Avenue of the Insurgents. You know, Pancho Villa and Zapata were the good guys. General Pershing was the bad guy. All of a sudden, they've turned our world around where the people are the bad guys, and they're the insurgents, and we're fighting the people. And that leads you into a whole new realm of warfare that's called counterinsurgency. And billions of dollars are being spent in counterinsurgency. Counterinsurgency is warfare against the people. So we're setting ourselves up in terms of language and what's laundered and what's permissible and who can resist, who can use force and who can't, to a situation where we're going to be justifying, you know, we're talking about a free capitalist, a free market capitalist system, you know, that, and you just have to read Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, to see what that means. And then we're legitimizing this capitalist state system to employ force against anybody that resists it, who are insurgents. So I think the Israel-Palestine conflict is only one case study of a much wider phenomenon of how we're being manipulated to see the people as the bad guys.
We're speaking with Jeff Halper, head of the Israeli Committee Against Housing Demolition. On CFMU 93.3, this is Unusual Sources. Jeff, I know you're speaking tonight at 7:30 at room 1A1.
Right here. That's
right. Right here, and we don't want to tire you out, but this is as much as we're hearing from Jeff, there's a lot more to hear from Jeff, too, because you got years of experience in this. I think, you know, those of us who've been paying attention to it, you know, can talk about the horrors and what's happened, but really, what you're doing is actually bringing it to a much broader base of people to have this discussion, so that people hear it for the first time. It's that a state, for example, has a policy of housing demolitions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as that's part of their war policy. It's not, you know, they got mad one day and they knocked a house down. This is a
60-year policy. You know, it began in 1948. It's a part of ethnic cleansing. And there's a wonderful book. It's a hard book, but it's a good book to read by Ilan Pappe, P-A-P-P-E, who's an Israeli historian who writes about the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. In 1948, that we came in, we Israelis came in and systematically demolished more than 500 entire Palestinian villages, driving 700,000 Palestinians out of the country. This isn't in the heat of battle. This is after the inhabitants of these villages left and became refugees. Then we destroyed the villages. These same refugees that we created, some of them went to live in Gaza. So the people whose homes we're demolishing today, the people we're killing today, are people we made refugees, the descendants. In other words, Israel has an ongoing war now for two generations against a people, and we're now killing the children and grandchildren of the people. And what does resistance mean? They're throwing rockets into Israel. They're throwing rockets into the very places where they were born. You know, it's not like some foreign country. We drove them out, and they're trying to resist a complete annihilation, trying to have some kind of right of return to their homes. We're saying, no, you can't come back, and we'll kill them if they try to. So there's a whole a double logic here, not only this issue of a war against Palestinians, but this is a war against refugees that we created. You would think Israel would have a special sensitivity to the people of Gaza, because these are the people that we sent into Gaza to live in this misery. We have to take responsibility for this. And I think the international community has to start holding Israel responsible for what it's doing, so that it's continued. 25,000 Palestinian homes demolished in the occupied territories, not because they're terrorists, but because we don't want them to have homes. We don't give them building permits. And now, by the way, there's a whole attack on Israeli citizens. There are 20 to 40,000 homes of Israeli citizens being targeted for demolition. And these citizens are, of course, Arabs, the Palestinian and Bedouin citizens of Israel. Last year, Israel demolished three times more houses of its own citizens who are Arabs than it did in the occupied territories. So this ethnic cleansing campaign of 60 years is far from over. And that's the perspective we have to use.
Well, this begs the next question. The apologists for Israel in the West always say it's the only democracy.
Yeah, right.
It's the only true democracy in the Middle East, although
First of all, that's nonsense. The Palestinians have a much better democracy than we do. They've had elections. They've been free elections. Jimmy Carter's been there to certify it. Unfortunately, they voted the wrong way. Because when they elected a Hamas government, the United States and Canada and Europe are all these, and Canada was first.
It was first.
That's
right.
Day
after the election.
That's right. All these countries that claim to be the protectors of democracy and freedom all over the world impose sanctions and won't talk to the elected government. So the Palestinians are very proud of their democratic traditions. At the same time, in Israel, we call ourselves a Jewish democracy. We don't call ourselves a democracy because this is a Jewish state. So the Jews in Israel have a privileged position over everybody else. So that, for example, last week, the Israeli parliament decided that the Arab parties would not be allowed to compete in the elections in two weeks from now. There's a law in Israel. Imagine this in Canada. There's a law in Israel that if an Israeli citizen marries someone from an Arab country, the Israeli citizen cannot bring his or her spouse back to live in Israel. Now, that's obviously, we don't say it that way because we're not discriminatory, right? It's obviously directed towards Arabs, towards Palestinians, because not that many Jewish Israelis marry people from Arab countries. So that you have a situation in which the fundamental right to marry and have a family is violated in this only democracy in the Middle East. Israel's got a long way to go, and I think the Israeli apologists have to understand that Israel's a real country. It doesn't help Israel, and it certainly doesn't help Israel's security and peace to defend absolutely indefensible policies. And the fact that the Jewish community here in Canada, that's liberal, that's educated, that's committed to human rights, nothing has defined the Jewish community in the West more than a commitment to human rights and social justice, defends house demolitions and massacres and occupation and racism is absolutely, it undercuts the entire moral fabric of the Jewish people in the diaspora. And I think somebody has to call them onto account. You know, Lucia, who's sitting with us, is part of a group called Not In My Name. Who are you people in the federations? Who are you rabbis? Who are you people to represent the Jew, not only represent the Jewish community, nobody elected you, but at the same time to present values, to defend things that absolutely are in violation of the most fundamental Jewish values. So I think this is a real issue that has to be brought up.
I couldn't agree more as a member of the Jewish community here. We have tried to engage with the Jewish community, but without much success. I want to ask you a question. I've been with you all day, and now I want to ask you a question because it derives from a recent book by David Grossman, a prominent Israeli writer, and if I can remember correctly, what he said was this, that Israel actually needs this conflict with the Palestinians because if it didn't have it, because of the very conditions in Israel, gross income disparities for one of them, you know, and all of the problems that you just talked about, it reminded me of that, that Israel would have a civil war. What do you think about that proposition?
I don't think it's true. It's an interesting idea, but I don't think so. I think that Israel has crystallized as a country. You know, people have come from all over the world, from the West and from Arab countries and Muslim countries. It's coalesced. I think there really is an Israel. It's a viable state with a viable culture and so on. It's true there's tremendous income disparities, but that's because we've been moving towards a Thatcherite system of privatization. The Israeli economy is actually very good. After all, you have an economy that's based on diamonds, arms, and security. I mean, those are pretty stable bases, even with given all the fluctuations today. So I don't accept that. I think that Israel could make peace, and on the contrary, if it made peace, it would flourish. You know, you have 100 million Arabs around that would be consumers, it would be partners, you'd open the borders. It'd be wonderful. You take your car and go drive to Morocco one weekend, go drive through Turkey. I mean, it would be a wonderful, wonderful place to be. And just one, it's funny because this is the Zionist idea. I mean, the Zionist idea, if you want to put it in those terms, is that the Jews return to the hearth of their civilization, which is the Middle East. You don't return and build walls and go massacre your neighbors and declare that you don't have any trust in them and build a ghetto. I mean, the very fact that the largest and probably the only Jewish ghetto in the world that remains today is Israel. You know, a walled-in Jewish community that can't move and feels insecure says that something is wrong in Israel. And in fact, you know, maybe Israel has become the most oppressive place for Jews to live and to free the Jews. You know, I have a good friend who's a Palestinian who was with me here in Canada, came on a tour with me a few years ago, whose house has been demolished four times. And he says, Israelis have to understand what's good for the Palestinians is good for the Israelis. And I think that's true. And that's the only way we're going to really have a normal, just society.
Well, Jeff, we've taken a lot of your time, and I know you got to eat and get prepared for the next lecture. We're speaking with Jeff Helper. He's head of the Israeli Committee Against Housing Demolition, and he's part of the Free Gaza Movement. And he'll be speaking tonight at 7:30 at room 1A1 at the Health Science or McMaster Hospital. You've got to come out and listen to him. Jeff, I know you've been traveling across the country, meeting with politicians and press people and with communities. The fact that there are such spokespeople from the Jewish community who can speak truth to power, it is inspiring to all those people that are involved in the human rights struggle, both here in Canada and across the world. And we really appreciate that you've come here to our studio today and that you've committed your life for the kind of justice that, as you said at the beginning of this interview, that's what most people in this world want, is justice. And it takes people of your courage to bring that message and to bring that justice to this world. So thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, and thanks to the Independent Jewish Voice and David Cohen for bringing me to Hamilton.
Yes, and I know, Lucia, you haven't said anything, but thank you for helping with this trip. And so, till tonight, and we'll continue this discussion. When you're back in Israel, we'll interview you by phone, or we'll remember unusual sources.
Very good.
Okay, thank you.